For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
It must be interesting and important for you to know.
The Paul Kurtman Show.
People that have some common sense and they're willing to say some things out loud that everybody else is just thinking.
When the left has the government, it's chaos and it's dangerous.
Paul Kurtman.
It's not really about the climate, it's about control.
This is The Paul Kurtman Show on News Talk STL.
And welcome to The Paul Kurtman Show here at News Talk STL. I am your host, Paul Kurtman. In the studio today with Ken Williams. And Ken, we've got so much to talk about because the moment that we've all been waiting for with bated breath has finally arrived, and that is the expiration of Title 42. And the border is erupting in chaos like we've never seen before. All entirely avoidable, but Joe Biden. And I guess I could just stop right there. But Joe Biden.
But Joe Biden.
So for those wondering exactly what Title 42 is, I wanna just kind of recap this because it's really easy when you're talking about the things in the news to just throw around different terminology, throw around different types of names of legislation, for example, and people kind of get lost wondering exactly what it is we're talking about. So here's what it is. Before Title 42, migrants could cross over the border illegally, but they could ask for asylum, and then they would be detained in the U.S. A lot of times they would just be released into the U.S. while their cases were pending. When COVID became an issue in March of 2020, President Trump issued Title 42, and what the, were you going to say something?
No. Go ahead. Finish up.
Title 42 allows us, under the, really on the grounds of preventing the spread of COVID, to turn anybody away no matter what. On the grounds of COVID, basically.
Right.
This is a very generic, basic. So now that Title 42 is expiring, this is basically opening up our border just as wider than it's ever been. And now we have, I would say tens of thousands, but the truth is it's closer to hundreds of thousands of migrants either staged on the border, currently staging on the border, or on their way to the border right now.
Yeah, and this Title 42 is installed under Donald Trump. And if you want to go back to the time that this was going on, remember when he needed a measly $5 billion to build the wall? Mm-hmm. And he wasn't allowed to get that from Nancy Pelosi. She refused to give him any money for the wall. So he had to try many different things. And Title 42 is one of those things to keep immigrants from coming across with not only COVID, but other diseases. And it was a temporary fix.
Yeah. And it was able to be passed. Really, it was able to really hold the force of law in the courts and everything else, primarily because of COVID.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the government was shutting people's businesses down. They were keeping kids out of school. The whole world was locking down. And we were stopping people from flying in from even England, right? From these other well-developed countries in Europe. Even those flights had stopped.
Yeah.
So, you know, Title 42, this was a means to an end that a lot of us had wanted for a long time, and that is just a secure border. But now Title 42 is expiring. Joe Biden has had years now as the president to get ahead of this situation. But here's what I don't understand. Like right now, I've heard that Guatemala has actually sent a memo to the U.S. warning them of hundreds of thousands of people or whatever the case is, all these people that are getting ready to flood the U.S. border. So like we have countries in Central and South America that are actually warning the U.S. of this right now. But I'm trying to figure out, where was Title 42, though, when Joe Biden took office? You remember all the Haitians that were coming into the U.S.?
You mean the ones that got whipped?
By the racist horses?
Yeah, by the racist Border Patrol agents.
So what happened to Title 42 then? Because we had all these Haitian migrants come across the border.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Has the border actually been tighter under Joe Biden's regime because of Title 42 than it was under Donald Trump? Because it seems to me that Joe Biden's just been letting people across the border, has all but suspended Title 42, at least in terms of enforcement. I'm just not exactly sure. But one thing I know is this. right now, it is beginning to shape up to look really, really bad. So I actually just went to Google and I went ahead and Googled U.S. border.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting the type of headlines that you see coming out from different media sources. I think it was the New York, I can't remember if it was the New York Times or the Washington Post. One of them said, what's happening at the border is not uncommon. It's actually not worse than it's ever been. But then you have other headlines that are saying chaos at the border because of Title 42. We're getting ready to see a rampant influx of migrants across the border. I've heard from reports that we've already seen 10,000 people a day already making their way across the border in the days leading up
to the
expiration of Title 42.
They broke the record.
Did they?
It's over 11,000 now a day.
Wow. Okay.
That's a new record. That's a new record that's never, ever been set in as immigrants, even knowing that immigrants are crossing at that number. But again, they don't know the exact number, Paul. They really don't know. You know, since Biden took office, they're estimating 6+ million people have crossed the border. That is like far and beyond more than Trump or anybody else in the history of this country has allowed over the border.
So that's what I'm asking, though, is like we have Title 42 right now, but it seems like it's been completely unenforced. So I don't know how it expiring actually makes the situation worse, because under the Biden administration, I mean, he pulled the National Guard back. They're not hiring new Border Patrol agents. They're just leaving. They have been, since he became the president, just letting people cross the border. So I'm wondering, and this is kind of a ridiculous, it seems like it should be a ridiculous question to ask, but this is a genuine question. Is Title 42, is the fact that it's expiring, is anything actually going to be worse than it was since Joe Biden took office? If it is it only because it's expiring and that's what's making news and driving more people here? I kind of feel like anybody that's wanted to cross the border illegally and stay probably could have at any time since Biden's been president.
Well, actually, they could have. What this does, though, is it gives them almost like a ticket to come over, you know.
They basically don't have to fear a rule, even if it's not being enforced. The rule's not even there.
Right. The rule's not there now. And I actually today saw a video of Border Patrol agents opening the big wall door and letting people in. And I see, I don't get this whole thing. We first heard that Joe Biden was going to be sending 1,500 National Guard troops to help the border. We find out that those National Guard troops are there as pencil pushers that are going to be pushing people through faster. The whole idea of them going down there will be to move people through faster instead of stopping them. Then we find out, and we read this report on Vic Porcelli's show, that we knew about this in 2022. There were emails released that Joe Biden already knew about sending these people down to move it along faster.
Well, do you remember the video? There was a video that made its way online of National Guardsmen walking up to a fence at the border and opening the fence to let them through.
Yeah.
Have you seen that video?
Yes, I did.
I used to have it on my website. I'm not sure which page it's on now. It's on one of the Paul Kirtman radio pages. If you scroll to the bottom at paulkirtman.com. But there's a video out there from when the National Guard was down there like about a year ago or so. And they got orders from the Biden administration to literally open the gate.
Yeah.
And so you see all these migrants on the other side of the border standing behind a locked gate. And the National Guard walks over, opens the gate, and then steps back and then just lets these people pour right through. What in the world is going on? When people get upset with their government, like Democrats and Republicans both, like this is something you can be upset about because this is a lawless government. Like there is nothing here that anybody can anchor them to as a point of reference for anybody in Washington, D.C., doing anything right. We'll get to more of that here in just a little bit because the Republicans are messing up a lot too, especially when it comes to finances.
Yeah.
But when you talk about the border, the left clearly wants an open border. And so I don't think it's necessarily going to get worse, except you made a really good point, Ken. Now we're not even going to have Title 42 on paper. Like it's not even going to be there on paper.
No, this is just free for all now, complete free for all. Paul, let's go back and to the estimates that they say that Joe Biden has let in since he's become president of the United States. Since January 20, 2021, Joe Biden has estimated letting in 6+ million people. Now, with the gotaways and everything, they're saying it could be as high as 11 million. Do you know that that's 6 million people is as much as are in the whole state of Missouri, for example?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yep. They have actually, now, keep in mind what their goal here is. The Biden administration has actually gained seats from just illegal immigrants coming into this country. If you count in the census, if you count the people, not saying who are going to vote, but I'm saying if you count the people that are coming into this country and they're coming into, they're putting them in areas that are blue areas, they're gaining seats somehow from this. And that's their goal. That's the ultimate goal. If they could get 100 million illegals in here and put them in blue areas or put them in areas where it will increase their opportunity to have another seat, they're going to do it.
We're talking about an increase in the U.S. population of 2 or 3% just in the last 2 years under the Biden administration because he's opened the gate at the border. We're not talking about the birth rate increases.
No.
We're not talking about legal immigration. We're talking about two or three out of every 100 people in the U.S. today has come here illegally since Biden has been in office. That is an astounding figure.
And I heard someone saying on social media, well, Trump had allowed people to come in as well. Okay, not even close to this number, first of all. But secondly, if you remember, if you go back to the days of Trump, he was fighting on a daily basis to get things done on the border, begging for money, trying to find other resources to use, and he couldn't get it from them.
And this is a good time. This is a good time to point out that the Republicans are just, and I'm just going to tell you, in my opinion, the Republicans are just as responsible for what
totally
we're seeing at the border.
Totally agree with you. Yep.
Like right now, we're pointing the finger directly at Joe Biden.
Well, his administration. Joe Biden, let's be clear. Joe Biden has nothing to do with any of this. He really doesn't. I mean,
well,
he's not.
He's the president. He could. He's the figurehead. He could sign executive orders. He is the president. He can do that. But you're
what
right.
What I'm saying is, no, Paul, I'm going on a different level here.
Okay.
The people behind the scenes behind him are telling him what to say and do.
Certainly. We have this whole cartel and cabal of the left, right?
Yeah, Obama, point, Susan
Rice.
Yes,
he's the figurehead. He's the guy at the top. I don't believe for a second he's entirely coherent the way he used to be.
No.
And even if he was, I don't know if it helped because he was a plagiarist and a liar, right?
Right.
But still, the president has the authority here. Congress even has the authority
Technically,
here.
Technically, you're right.
The Republicans are just as much to blame as the left is on this issue because when Donald Trump wanted money for the wall, who had the government? The Republicans did. The Republicans had Congress. The Republicans had the Senate. The Republicans held the purse strings. They could have appropriated $5 billion to build a wall along the southern border. And guess what, folks? It's constitutional.
Yeah.
Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution. The federal government has the responsibility and the duty to protect the borders of our states from an invasion. And you can define invasion however you want, but nevertheless, it's in the Constitution that they have to protect our border. And guess who was in charge? Paul Ryan, as the Speaker of the House in 2016. And what did they do? They were the ones, the Republicans were the ones, that started the Mueller probe to investigate Donald Trump. He wanted money to secure the borders, and what did they do? They launched a committee to investigate him that the Democrats eventually got to take control over whenever they took the House, and they took it to a completely different level. In fact, I would even go so far as saying that Donald Trump was impeached twice, in large part due to the fact that the Republicans got it all started when they had the government.
Exactly.
And so we could have got ahead of this border issue a long time ago, but we didn't because Republicans failed. And you know what? Republicans are always pointing the finger. The establishment saying, well, these conservatives are holding things up. And the conservatives are saying, well, you know, we can't get anything done because of the establishment. And that's more correct than the other way around, right?
Absolutely.
But nevertheless, the Republican Party is failing America. Absolutely failing America because they're more interested in the politics than they are the principles that they swore an oath to defend in terms of protecting our country, our freedom, and our borders.
Yep.
Now I'm all on fire for segment two, Ken. Hey, and when we come back, let's talk a little bit about how Republicans are continuing to fail. You might think this is not just a Republican bashing show, folks. But hey, the Republicans have a lot to be accountable for. But we're going to talk about that right here when we come back on the Paul Kirtman Show, 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
Follow Paul on social media at Paul Kirtman. This is the Paul Kirtman Show on News Talk STL. For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com. You're listening to the Paul Kirtman Show on News Talk STL.
We've seen three bank failures this year. Two more regional banks appear to be on the edge. Do you still believe that our banking system is strong and resilient? We don't have a systemic problem?
I do believe that. I believe our banking system has strong capital levels and access to liquidity. We've taken decisive action to make sure that difficulties at a few banks don't create contagion that undermines the confidence of depositors in the safety of their deposits in the banking system. And the tools we used previously, we would be prepared to use again if necessary.
There you go. That is Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen, and she is talking about how our banking industry is still safe, it is strong, it's robust. And this is where I kind of know that I'm going to step on a few toes here.
Okay.
Because it is very popular. I'll start stepping right now. It is very popular, right, to always bash the government. Always, right? And I'm one of those guys who helps popularize that because there's right. plenty of reasons to go after the government. I believe that Janet Yellen is right here, but I also think that she's wrong on a huge, huge level. So here's why she's right, okay? We saw these bank failures earlier this year, and we're still seeing some remnants of that, and there's still fears out there that we're going to see more banks fail. The reasons that we've seen banks fail is because they've taken depositors' money, and I've said this before, they've taken depositors' money, and whenever the bank takes your money, they take it and they invest it. Because they want to get a return. That's how the bank makes money.
Right.
So what they did, though, is what they should do. Banks should invest depositors' money in very short-term investments. That way, it's always coming due. It's always liquid. So that way, when you go to the ATM, you can get your cash back.
Okay? Right.
You don't want the bank to lock up all your money because you're going to need your money, right? Well, what the bank did, what some of these banks did, like Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic, they did lock up depositors' money for a long time. And when you lock up people's money for a long time in investments like bonds, and if during that time that money's locked up, if interest rates start going up, the value of those bonds go down until they mature. That's when you get your money back. So here's how this works, Ken. If you're the bank and I give you $1,000 and you put that into a bond that's earning 5% rate of return, that's a pretty good return. But if interest rates go up to 8 or 9%, well, nobody wants that bond, so you can't sell it on the market for how much it's actually going to be worth when it matures. You just have to sell it for whatever anybody's willing to pay for it.
Mm,
okay?
Yeah.
So if I need my money back and you have to sell your bond, I'm not getting all my money back because you're selling that bond at a deep discount because the market's not going to pay you much for it, right? You actually would have to hold it until it matures to get all of my money and your interest back. So that's what's happened. So the Federal Reserve went to these banks and they said, hey, we will bail you out. It's kind of a bailout. It kind of is and it kind of isn't in the general sense that people understand bailouts. It is in the sense that we saved the bank. It's not a bailout in the sense that we just went in and just gave the bank money. What we did is the Federal Reserve went in and bought those bonds at their maturity value, not the current market value that they're worth right now.
So that's a bailout.
It's a bailout in the sense that they saved the bank.
Right.
But it's not a bailout in the sense that they just gave the bank money that the bank already would not have had if they just waited a couple more years. So it's not like that money wasn't ever going to come back. It's just that the bank needed the money now.
Okay, but I always go back to this idea that would the government have done that for me?
Yes and no. So right now, so first off, when the government does that for a bank, the government's doing that for the sake of the depositors. So the bank, so the government is doing that for the depositors, but these are highly wealthy depositors in Silicon Valley, all these tech startups. People now, like...
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yeah. What I'm talking about, if the government, if I needed something, I'm not talking about necessarily exactly that situation,
mm-hmm.
but if I needed something, if I needed money for something, would the government bail me out? Would the government say, hey, Ken, I know you needed money for that. Let's give that to you. I don't think they would readily do that.
If you needed,
for an individual.
If you needed money, let's parse this out. Let's do this. Listeners, I hope you're okay with this. This is going to be kind of interesting, this little discussion Ken and I are having. If you needed money because you went in over your head on a Corvette.
Okay.
No. But if you decided, Ken, that you did not want to work and you just wanted to be taken care of, and you wanted to be bailed out of ever having to work,
okay,
then the answer is yes. Because we have entitlement programs, and we have millions upon millions upon millions of Americans that are more interested in getting their entitlements than they are of actually finding their own economic mobility and working their way up the economic ladder.
Okay.
So there's a lot of bailouts going on.
No, you're right. I wasn't thinking that way. I was thinking of as a working person, you know, paying his bills on time, working
the
for that money.
The answer is no. I know where you're going with this.
Okay.
The answer
but
is no.
But you're right and I'm right because you're right, because, yes, I've seen a breakdown of what a person who is unemployed, if they do it correctly, they can earn up to $3,600 a month on the government's
feet. Ken, listen to this. The very first phone call I ever got as a state lawmaker is exactly what we're talking about. You ready for a story to blow your ever-loving mind?
Here we go.
Listen to this. This is the first phone call I ever got. This phone call came to my office in Jefferson City in January of 2011. I had a man from my district call me, and he was upset with the government. And I'm thinking to myself, hey, a kindred spirit. No. He wasn't upset with government fraud, waste, and abuse. He wasn't upset with politicians abusing their authority and their power. He was upset. This is what he said. He said, between me, my son, and my wife, we're only making about $50,000 a year off of all the different entitlement benefits. He didn't use the word entitlement benefits because a lot of people don't use those words.
No, they don't. Right.
He goes, we're only making about $50,000 a year. And he said, how do you expect us to live off of that? Between him, his wife, and his son, all of them are healthy. I asked him this. All of them have had jobs. They could be working, but they instead choose to be on the government's dollar, the people's dollar, because they would rather not work. That was the first call I ever got.
That blows my mind.
It blew my mind.
You are correct. It blows my mind.
It blew my mind. I actually told this guy, I said, when he said, how do you expect us to live off of that? I said, I don't. I said, I don't expect you to live off of that. I don't expect you to live off the government, right? I don't expect you to live off your fellow American citizen, the people that are out there paying the taxes. But anyway, I'm just saying all this. Let's get back to Janet Yellen, what she said. The banking industry, I believe, is safer than what right now we're probably conditioned to believe because of the headlines, because what happened just in the last couple months is not the same as what we saw in 2008. However, it could be the same if it turns out that this is a much more rampant issue than we're even aware of, because eventually the government, the taxpayers, will have to go in. And what right now is turning into a short term, a bailout of a sort, right? Like we're basically buying their bonds.
Yeah.
So like that money's coming back to us. But if it turns into a bailout where we have to create new money and do things like quantitative easing and inflate the currency even more to bail people out, that's going to spell even further disaster. How much time do we got left in this segment, Ken?
Oh, we got about 6 minutes.
Okay, perfect. I want to play another clip because this is Kevin McCarthy. I think this is clip 14. Let's play Kevin McCarthy talking a little bit about this debt limit increase that they're debating in Washington, D.C. right now.
You said at the very beginning we had to show you a plan, even though the Democrats have shown no plan. Not only did we show you a plan, we're the only ones to pass a plan. So I think it's up to you now. Whether the economy goes in any trouble, it's you, because the Republicans raised the debt limit. You have not. Neither has Schumer.
Okay, I am about ready to turn this studio counter over. Like, I mean, I'm about to Hulk out and start smashing some things. I wish that Kevin McCarthy and the rest of the Republicans would have as much vim and vigor to actually start cutting spending as they do with plain politics about the debt ceiling. This is what he's saying. Somehow, and I like Kevin McCarthy, but I 100% disagree with this approach. He is taking the position that we're the real heroes because we actually have a plan to raise the debt ceiling. I'm sorry. But that is not a plan. That is not a plan for the future to constantly be raising the debt ceiling.
We've heard it many, many times, kicking the can down the road. I know that it's going to be a painful thing to take money away from programs. And when I say that, I'm not talking about the main Medicare, Medicaid, you know, all of those, Social Security. I'm not talking about that. But there are so many other programs where we can cut money. We can cut funds, and it's not going to hurt straight directly to the American people.
It is nothing short of virtue signaling for Kevin McCarthy to say, we have a plan to further demise America's financial future and financial footing in the world. We have a plan to raise the debt ceiling. Ken, that would be like me maxing out all my credit cards, and when one of my bills comes due, instead of paying the bill or instead of finding other ways to cut spending, I stand up in front of you and I say, hey, I have a plan to take us deeper into debt. I'm the only one here with a plan to make sure that we are drowning in debt for the rest of our lives. I have a plan. It is counterfeit virtue for the Republican Party right now to be thinking that we should be applauding them because they have a plan to raise the debt ceiling. And what you were just saying right now about cutting, people don't like to do this, right? Every year there's opportunities for us to cut costs, even without cutting corners. I don't know why, but the Republican Party should make a big deal out of Rand Paul's, what does he call it? He calls it his, what is the old holiday from Seinfeld?
Festivus. Festivus for the rest
of us. The airing of grievances.
Okay.
So Rand Paul, this is what he's done. He has the airing of grievances. And what he does is he takes a book that talks about government waste, all kinds of government waste. Senator Tom Coburn, who's passed away, was a U.S. senator from the state of Oklahoma. He introduced the government waste book, and he would compile every year a book of nothing but government waste. We're talking hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. Since he has left office, his successor, James Lankford, Senator James Lankford, has picked up that mantle, and he is wearing it now, too. Here is the government waste book. There is so many areas where we could be cutting spending, not without cutting corners, right? Like, there are people that have paid into things like Social Security and Medicare. They've paid in. And I say, if you've paid in, you have a right to receive that obligation to come back to you. But when we're talking about spending $20 million to study how male mice prostitute out female mice in exchange for seeds or pieces of cheese or whatever the case may be, we need to find these people who are spending this kind of money and parade them around Washington, D.C. and say this is who people like us are being elected to stop, this type of person. But instead, no, Kevin McCarthy is saying, congratulate us, pat us on the back, because we're going to go deeper into debt, and we're the only ones with a plan to go deeper into debt.
What we have to do, we have to cut spending. And why can't we take that book that you're talking about that they have every year, go through it, and drop those programs? Just drop them. You know what? I know it's not politically correct to do all this stuff. It's not politically expedient. I know it's not politically popular. I don't care anymore. There's only so much more money that we can actually print before we're going to inflate ourselves out of existence.
We are. And whether we raise the debt ceiling or we don't raise the debt ceiling, we talked about this a little bit on last week's show, the consequences are the same. We still stand to diminish our credit rating. Because if we don't raise the debt ceiling, people say, U.S. government, They don't have any more money, so let's lower their credit rating. But if we do raise the debt ceiling, they say, uh-oh, U.S. government is over-leveraging itself. They may not be good for their next bill. So either way, the outcome is the same. Either way, interest rates still go up. Either way, inflation becomes a problem. So what we need is we need a plan not to raise the debt ceiling, but a plan to start resolving the issue of our debt.
So it's inevitability.
I mean, it is.
It's inevitable that this is going to happen. Or meanwhile, you have groups like China, the Communist Party, they're saying, no, use our currency as the reserve. Use our currency,
yes.
And then because that American currency is not as reliable as it used to be.
That's right.
Any longer. So they're going to other countries and really making us look bad. But other countries are adopting it.
They are. And you have countries like China, like you just mentioned, they are playing the long game. And they know that, listen,
they always have, Paul.
We are
they
China's.
They always have.
We are their number one customer.
Yeah.
People talk about like a Red Dawn scenario. We're going to go to war with China. There's going to be fighting in the streets. And we find a way to popularize this, romanticize this in Hollywood. Listen, this is going to be the most boring takeover you've ever experienced. Because you're going to start losing your stuff. And that's really about it. Because we're their number one customer. They've been playing the long game for so long, for decades now, we've been playing right into their hand. And that's why they're getting the influence around the world that used to be ours.
Yep.
Thanks, Kevin McCarthy. That's what we want. We want a plan to go deeper into debt. Forget about spending. Forget about actually resolving the debt itself. Hey, when we come back, let's get a little deeper. Ken, there's an epidemic of loneliness. I got some pretty startling facts and figures that Google has been able to demonstrate from their search results. We'll talk about that when we come back here in a minute on The Paul Kirpin Show, 101.9/94.1 News Talk STO.
Follow Paul on social media at Paul Kirkman. This is The Paul Kirkman Show on News Talk STL. For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com. You're listening to The Paul Kirkman Show on News Talk STL.
Okay, folks. Time for the third and final segment of The Paul Kirkman Show. It's going to be a little sad. I'm just going to tell you right now.
Aww.
But I think a lot of people can relate to this because either you're in this situation or you know people that are, or maybe you have children and you're just concerned about them having friends. But listen to this. Ken's talking about information that'll blow your mind. I had no idea the type of effects that not having enough friends or not having good friends can actually have on your physical health.
Mm.
I had no idea.
Wow.
So listen to this. Earlier this month, the Surgeon General, we often refer to him as America's top doctor, Vivek Murthy, he released an 81-page report on the epidemic of loneliness and isolation, bringing attention to the concerning trend of social disconnection in America. And in a guest essay in the New York Times, this is what he does. He cites several studies that show how prolonged loneliness affects our physical and mental health negatively. Listen to this. It is akin to smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow.
So that would increase your risk of heart disease, cancer, anxiety, depression, even dementia, all this stuff. So listen, I'm gonna read a little bit from an article here. And this article I'm getting from Charter, there's a really neat email newsletter that goes out called Charter, where they just take interesting data and they kind of break it down and help you understand it. They actually picked up on this and they wrote a little bit about it. And they said, while it is true that the percentage of Americans who report feeling lonely has fallen from the very peak of pandemic loneliness, right? Because during the pandemic, people were isolated. We were forced into isolation. Suicide rates skyrocketed.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that. They said that the trend of loneliness has actually increased, arguably, years before the lockdown, and that it's actually, let me see, the average time spent alone has increased by 12 hours a month. It doesn't seem like much, but it is. 12 hours a month between 2003 and 2019. You know what's happened between 2003 and 2019?
The internet?
The internet and social media.
Yeah.
So as we get more friends, as we get more followers, as there's more social media interaction, there is a correlation with people actually becoming more isolated and, in fact, unsocial or non-social. So if you were to go to Google, if you can go to Google and you can type in different phrases and you can see what the trends look like, this is crazy. People have actually been Googling where to make friends. And back in 2000, that amount that people have actually Googled that phrase, where to make friends, in the last 10 years has gone up 500%.
I don't doubt that at all. I mean, you have, of course, you had COVID, but, and I think what that did, it put social media on a fast track, you know, during that time that people were locked down, but it's always been growing since the time you're talking about. And I think people have been replacing that natural ability to meet people and the socialist nature of it, the socialization
right
between people, you know, naturally knowing how to socialize is being lost because of social media. And because when you're sitting behind your computer, you don't need to have those tools. You don't need those socialization tools.
And I think when people are sitting at their computer, they get this false sense of social satisfaction when they like or comment on somebody else's page.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, you don't, in many cases, you don't know these people. They don't know you.
Right.
And so you see all this social interaction happening online, and it's anything but actually social. There, we have politicians. We have one politician in Missouri. I won't say his name. I really want to say his name, but I'm not going to. He's a friend. He's in office. But I remember in one of his campaigns, we were joking around. This is not his name, but I'll just say his name is Mike. Okay. We would joke around and we'd be like, you know, there's Facebook Mike and then there's real life Mike. Real life Mike is a super nice, happy-go-lucky, really laid back, genuine and sincere, care for you, give you the shirt off your back kind of guy.
Yeah.
And then there's Facebook Mike. And Facebook Mike is a rip your head off, spit down your throat, make you feel like a little tiny insignificant person. And this is what we see happening with social media when people begin to create these chasms between what's real and what's not real, because there are things that you might say on Facebook or on Twitter, but you would never say it to somebody's face, not because it's not rude, not because you don't want to say it, but because, you know, if you say it to someone's face, you might also get your teeth knocked in.
Okay. Now, that is a rule that I go by now, and I always have, actually. And I get pretty bold on Twitter, but I've always said to myself, before I hit that send button, would you say that to that person's face? And it's some things I may not say it exactly like that, but I would actually to someone that I don't know debate them and say it. And so I, you know, would either send it or I would rephrase it to where it does fit to what I would say to them. If I was standing in front of you and I totally disagreed everything that you're saying, thought it was insane for you to be saying what you're saying, because I've seen it a lot online.
Mm-hmm.
Then would I say that to you in front of you? Yes, I would, because I don't know you and I really feel strongly about this opinion. Then I send it. Otherwise, I rephrase it.
And it's a kind of a fine line, right?
It really is.
It's a balancing act to walk, because there's things that you want to say. You believe that there's truth and you want to speak the truth to people in the middle of a discussion or a debate online. But there are so many different social cues that you read when you're talking to somebody face to face that you don't get online. For example, the way that I'm talking right now, I can get real quiet. I can get really quiet and make my point, or I can get really loud, you know, and show you my passion. You can see my countenance on my face, the inflection in my voice, the tone, but you can't get any of that online. And I think that we're not only seeing people become more lonely. I think that we're seeing people become more lonely. They might still be around the same amount of people because they go to work, they go to school, they have a family, but they feel lonely because they're not making social connections. They're not actually bonding with people. Like, there are people that I disagree with in Jefferson City. I've had plenty of debates, and like, I disagree with them passionately, but I feel a bond with them too, because we have both shared our views passionately on a single issue, and we've been able to develop a certain sense of trust and vulnerability with each other that we can trust each other with, even if we disagree on things. You don't get any of that on a computer screen.
And you've developed that trust in socialization in front of each other. Mm-hmm. I've actually had people online just come back amazingly angry at me. And I'm like, wait a minute, you don't get what I'm saying. And they say, oh, I understand perfectly. Then I explain it to them. I say, no, you're not understanding. And because they don't see those social cues that you're talking about, they don't get it. They don't get it because they don't see all that. And then they go, oh, I get it now.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to explain it to them. Whereas if they were in front of me and I was explaining something, initially they would understand just by my visual cues and the inflection in my voice and the pitch and all that stuff, the tone. You know, they would get it right away. But you can't get that when you're doing this on social media, pure and simply texting.
So I don't want to just end this show and this segment on just a bunch of bad news.
Yeah.
I got a couple tips here.
Okay. Oh, that'd be good. Okay. That'd be really good.
A way to improve your situation, the way to improve your circumstances in terms of friends. Okay. So there's a couple things. I'll tell you a quick little story. When I first came out of the Marine Corps, I was a sergeant in the Marines. I was in the infantry. So, you know, we're training for war fighting, all this stuff. And I loved it. I mean, I ate it up. Like, yeah. If they could have put me on a poster because I ate nails and MREs and mud every day, I would have done it in a heartbeat. I loved it. But when you're in that type of environment, you're not out just laughing and smiling and you're not really cordial with people. So I came out of that and I got involved in politics. I'm giving speeches. And I think people were really attracted to my speeches because I sounded like a drill instructor. And people could sense that passion, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So people liked to listen to me. But when the speech was over, nobody wanted to come talk to me.
No, okay.
And somebody told me, they said, Paul, one thing you should probably do is while you're giving speeches, from time to time, just smile. I was like, I hadn't even occurred to me. Smile a little bit.
Wow,
so
that's
you
powerful.
So you seem approachable. And so I started doing that, and I'm telling you, It was so obvious. As soon as I started smiling a little bit more, looking at people in my, like, I'd get really passionate about something, but then I'd smile at somebody and say, but we can fix this, you know, and I'd smile. And it is warm. It's inviting. And I got that from somebody who mentioned that to me, but I also read a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And in that book, I read the whole thing.
That book has a history.
It does have a history. I've read it. I've read it twice. And I will dog-ear my pages. I'll write notes in the margins. I want to study that book. And so one thing that people should do if they want to have more friends, they should study friendliness. So read the book, like, and try to practice some of those things. Like, be a good listener.
Oh, that's like probably number one in the rule book.
Mm-hmm. So I would say the first thing is this. Study what it means. Study how to make friends. How to make friends and influence people. Dale Carnegie, it's a book I highly recommend. Another thing is this. Practice empathy. Practice empathy. Try putting yourself in other people's shoes because it gives you a new perspective on how to approach them about whatever it is that you need to talk to them about. And when you can approach somebody the right way, in a way that is warm and inviting, a way that makes them glad that you approached them, they will want to be around you more often. It makes you sticky, and people want to stay closer to you.
Now, let me know if I'm doing this wrong, but sympathy is different than empathy in that empathy are things that you've actually experienced with that person, are the same type of things you've experienced with that person. You can empathize with someone if you've been through what they've been through. You can sympathize with them if you haven't gone through it, but you understand what they're going through.
Well, that's both empathy. So here's the way I would explain it. There's a difference between care and concern. I would say being concerned is like having sympathy for somebody. Okay. Having care for somebody is like empathy. Okay. So here's care and concern. I'm concerned about the plight of the Kurdish people in northern Iraq.
Okay.
I'm concerned. Right?
Yeah.
I follow it a little bit, but do I actually care for them in that situation? Well, I haven't actually done anything to actually tend to their life or their plight. So do you want a nurse to be concerned for you or do you want a nurse to care for you? I want a nurse to care for me, not just be concerned. So sympathy is kind of along the lines of being concerned, like I feel sorry for you, I feel bad for you. But when I have empathy, I am doing everything I can to put myself in your shoes because I want to have a better understanding so I would know how to help.
Okay.
So if people can practice empathy, that will go a long way in helping you find friends. And water seeks its own level. So if you can really empathize with somebody, that becomes an open gate to really making friends. And then the other one is this. Here's the last one. The Bible says if you want to have friends, you need to show yourself to be friendly. Now, this is one that's really, really hard for people. So for all the people out there that are lonely, if you're right now Googling how to make friends, here is the advice that is time-tested, an old ancient proverb from the Holy Scripture. If you want to make friends, just be friendly. It's really that simple.
And that is very simple, but it's not something you think about.
It's not something you think about, and it's kind of hard to do because how do you be friendly to somebody that you're not actually friends with? Here's a couple ideas. Smile more often. Be open to greeting them. How are you doing? And ask open-ended questions to get them involved in a conversation. Hold the door open for people. Look for an opportunity to help somebody do something. And this is where empathy comes into play. If you can empathize with somebody, you'll see those opportunities to help them more often. But if you want to have friends, just start being friendly. And everybody else out there who's Googling the same thing about how do I get friends, they will come running to people who are friendly to them. But the thing is it takes a little bit of initiative because you have to be mindful of whether or not you're being friendly with people. And let me just say this too. If we could all just be a little bit more friendly in this country, it would go a long way to helping in opening doors of discussion and dialogue so we could actually find the truth of some of these issues and actually unify the American people. Just be friendly.
And left alone and unfettered, I could see that happening. But when you have a certain party, which is the Democrat Party, which they thrive on division, that is where it gets tough to be able to do something like that.
Hey.
But the easiest thing to do, I think, one of these rules, I think I've read this a long time ago, is, you know, show someone, ask someone questions about themselves. Mm-hmm. People like to talk about themselves, and that opens them up when you ask them a question about themselves.
That's actually in How to Win Friends and Influence People.
I think I've read it a long time ago.
Yeah, you can stand there. When I was knocking doors, I knocked on the door of this guy. He came to the door, and he says, this is my first campaign in Jefferson County. He goes, I've always voted Democrats, but I'm not voting. He goes, I voted for Barack Obama, but I'm not voting for that guy again. And I thought to myself, all right, he's seen the light. This guy's a Republican now. He's conservative. Yeah. But then he said, I'm not voting for him again because he's not doing everything he said he would do. And then he started going down the whole list of like the Communist Manifesto. I'm thinking to myself, I got to get out of here. This is a lost cause. I got to get out of here. I'm wasting time. I need to knock on doors. But as he's going through his whole list of grievances with how the Democrat Party is not far enough to the left, suddenly, and I'm just listening, just kind of smiling and nodding, being, you know, nice.
Yeah.
Suddenly out of the blue, he goes, and another thing, the government's going to take my guns. If we're not careful, government's coming for our guns. I stood there and talked to this guy about the importance of the Second Amendment for 20 minutes. And you know what? He voted for me and took yard signs to stick in his yard and his other family members' yards, all because I was friendly. This guy who never voted for a Republican or a conservative in his life voted for one because he was friendly. He voted for me because I was friendly, found an area that we had some common ground, and we built a relationship around the common ground.
That's awesome. That's so good.
Hey,
time runs out quickly.
It does. If you want to be friends, if you want to make friends, be friendly.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, we will be back next week, same time, 12 to 1, Paul Kirpin Show, me and Ken Williams. Right here at 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
The only thing that says I'll never be like you. Every time I see myself.
The Paul Kirtman Show. For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.